holiday season is around the corner and I love hosting, but there's so much stuff needed and few places in my house to put it all. Wayfair's Black Friday sale is the time to get great deals on all things home, no matter what your style. Shop the can't-miss Black Friday deals all month long, and then you can sit back and relax because with Wayfair's fast and easy shipping, it's no problem at all. I ordered a new bookshelf cabinet where I can hide away my napkins, napkin holders, candlesticks, charger plates, and all the decorative things that I like to rotate between when the seasons change and different guests are over during the holidays. I found one that was the exact look I had on my vision board, and my husband liked it too, so win-win. There are so many to choose from, and it's a breeze to find the right one that fits your style, size, and space. So if you are also overflowing with books and seasonal items, you're going to love their selection of cabinets. If you're like me and love a loyalty program, you can earn rewards and get the best savings in the neighborhood with Wayfair's new loyalty program. 5% back on every item across Wayfair's family of brands, free shipping, members-only sales, and more. Terms apply. Don't miss out on early Black Friday deals. Head to Wayfair.com now to shop Wayfair's Black Friday deals up to 70% off. That's Wayfair.com. Sale ends December 7th.
What's up, everyone? This is Cece. If you're a longtime listener of this podcast, then chances are you've heard me talk about the importance of writing on a line level. And of course I have. Because while movies get to rely on lighting, soundtrack, acting, and special effects, books rely only on words to make a story come to life, which is why the writing matters so much. My question to you is, are you confident about your writing? Do you feel like it's at the level it needs to be to stand out in the competitive publishing landscape? If you're like most writers I know, then you're always looking for ways to improve. Well, what if I told you that there's a way to supercharge your learning experience by hacking writing on a line level? That's right, hacking it. I've developed an original 4-day course, Hacking Writing on a Line Level, that will show you specific techniques to elevate your writing on a word level, sentence level, paragraph level, and scene level. This course begins on December 4th. My favorite part about it is that there are clear, specific examples in every single slide. No fluff, all actionable content. And for the first time ever, we'll have an optional interactive component. Students are invited to submit excerpts from their work for a chance to have them critiqued live during a class. I'm super excited about this new format because I've seen it yield results in writers' works. And it works for writers of any genre, as long as you're serious about improving your writing on a line level, and as long as you're a reader. So if you're ready to take your writing to the next level, join me for this 4-day course. It's a fan favorite. Don't worry if you can't attend live. The sessions will be recorded. For more information, check out my bio on Instagram or the podcast website. I'm looking forward to seeing you there.
Hi there, and welcome to our show, The Shit No One Tells You About Writing. I'm best-selling author Bianca Murray, and I'm joined by Cece Lira of Wendy Sherman Associates and Carly Waters of PS Literary.
Hi everyone, it's my huge, huge pleasure today to be joined by Patricia Sands, who is one of my favorite people, who is an excellent literary citizen and a brilliant writer, and it's been overdue that we have you on the show, Patricia, so welcome.
Oh, thank you, Bianca. Wow, that made me feel very good. What a way to start the morning. It's a pleasure to be here.
Your bio is so impressive. It's so long. Can you just tell us a tiny bit about yourself? And then we're going to dive in to your extraordinary story in terms of publication, which I know our listeners are going to love.
Okay, well, let me see. I've lived in Toronto for most of my life. Also had a fairly nomadic existence with my second husband. I was widowed when I was 43. I went back to university and became a teacher, taught for a little while, remarried, started traveling a lot with my husband. I went from having 2 children to having 7 children. And so we're a large blended family. But I started writing at 65, just really kind of by accident. I write like I talk, and I talk a lot. So maybe that's why I started writing. So my first novel was the Bridge Club. And it was about my real life bridge club, 8 women, and our friendship from the time we were in our late teens, early 20s, into our 70s. And I didn't even intend to publish it. I was just writing it for us. But anyway, I did publish and I indie pubbed because I did go through the process and I did send out some query letters, but I was 65, first time author, and a nobody. So I wasn't high on any literary wish list. So I indie pubbed and I used the same company that Lisa Genova had used for Still Alice. I figured that was going to be a solid group, and it was. I had a good experience. Anyway, I started hearing from readers and they'd ask what else I had written, and I had written nothing. But I had also gotten involved with the writing community and I realized I loved writing, so I continued with my next book. My husband and I have spent a lot of time in the south of France and I wanted to set my books there. I also heard from women who said they really like reading about older women, more mature women. And that was a pleasure for me to write about. So I indie pubbed 3 books. And then one morning I opened my computer and there was an email saying, "Good morning, Patricia. I'm a senior acquisitions editor with Amazon's Lake Union Publishing."
So let's start with the starting writing at 65. I mean, how do you mean by accident? Tell us about that.
Well, my husband had a lot of health issues kick in. And so I had more time on my hands. And I was talking with one of the women in the Bridge Club one day, because we're all still very good friends. And she said, "So why don't you start writing the Bridge Club?" Which we had joked about, like for 40 years, we had joked about, "Okay, Pat, you should write the book." And so I just did. I just started writing. And it was fun. Because I was writing about people I knew, I had to talk to each one of them again because some of the things I was writing about had happened so many years ago. I didn't remember all the details, but each one of them, it was their story. So they remembered the details. And of course, it became fictionalized as I went along and I realized I couldn't include some things and I needed to embellish other things. And it just became this wonderful project. And I never intended to publish it. But then they started saying, "Well, you know, I showed this to my girlfriend and everybody thinks you should publish. You're telling women's stories. It would be a really good book club book." And so that's what happened there.
Did you try and get an agent originally for that book? Or were you just like, "I'm going to self-publish this"? How did that process look?
No, I really, because I read about, I knew nothing about, you know, the writing world or the publishing business. So I followed the website of Terry Fallis, who is a Canadian author. And
Shout out to Terry. We love you, Terry.
Yeah, exactly. He probably doesn't remember, but I did bump into him on a couple of occasions. And he always gave me real encouragement about just get out there and drive around with boxes of your books to all the bookstores and you know, this sort of thing, which I didn't necessarily do, but he was just so encouraging. So in following his website, I saw who he had first indie pubbed with, the company. And also I was reading an interview with Lisa Genova around the same time. I remember this going back 15 years. And she had published through this same company, indie pubbed. So I thought, well, if they both use that company, I'm going to use it, because I figured they would have done their homework. And I'd been researching all these different publishing companies, but I had no idea what I was doing. So anyway, I used this company. I'm not going to mention the name of it because it gets some bad press. Because of course, what they want you to do is buy their marketing program and, you know, pay money for this and pay money for that. But in all honesty, I had the best experience with them, and I do mention that and thank them at the end of my book, and I had excellent editors. They were great, and so that set me off on this voyage, and then when I started hearing from readers, which was such a surprise to me, I thought, well, yeah, I really did love writing that book, and I was learning so much about the craft of writing, and I had become involved with a lot of writers because I took a blogging course and, you know, those were in the days when your blog was really important. And so, yeah, it just started to become part of my world.
For those of you who don't know, so Terry Fallis started his career by self-publishing and is now like a best-selling author in Canada. Every book he brings out is on the bestseller list for weeks and weeks. He's very popular. You know, so you were talking about Still Alice, right? So that was also self-pubbed originally and then published traditionally. So this is something a lot of our listeners ask about. Like, is it possible if I can't get an agent to self-publish and get the attention of agents or publishers down the line? And this is exactly what happened with you. So you self-published those three independent books and then you got approached by Lake Union Publishing. So tell us a bit about what they then wanted to do and what they were offering you.
Right. Well, it was Danielle Marshall, who was the senior acquisitions editor at the time. And I like to mention her name because I don't think I'd be where I am today had it not been for her sending me that email. And it was such an amazing experience to think that they were interested in my books. And Lake Union bought the rights to my Love in Provence trilogy, or what started off as just my book number two, and I thought it was just going to be a standalone book. But again, I started hearing from readers saying, well, they're talking about Kat, the main character, and at the end of the book, she was living in France. So did she stay? Did she go? What happened? Tell us more about her story. So all my writer friends said, well, that's great. You can turn it into a series. So that was my intention. So Lake Union said, that's great. We'll take your first two books. We'll do another edit. We'll change the cover. And then we will republish. And when you finish book three, we'll publish that as well. I was really proud to say that when they re-edited, they hardly changed anything, which made me feel really good about the freelance editors that I had used. And they sent me a bunch of different choices for the covers. And I loved my covers. A young man in Toronto had worked with me and done watercolor paintings of each cover. And then we had them formatted into the book cover. And that was something else I heard from a lot of my readers. You know, we love your covers. I should have them with me and I don't. But they're beautiful covers. And that also is just a lesson that's always stayed with me about the importance of covers. And when I take the books into, I showed a woman who just opened a new bookshop near Collingwood, where I live now. And she looked at those books yesterday, and the first thing she said was, oh, I love the covers. So,
did you get to keep those covers with Lake Union, or did they completely want to change them?
Yes. No, they kept them, and they just put a different, I can't think of what you call it, but a different block on the cover that showed the title and my name. And but that was the only difference. And so they republished the first two, and then they published the third. And then they said, okay, well, that's great, but now we'd like you to write a standalone. And by this time, I was in my 70s. And I said, well, you know, I really only want to write about the south of France. It's such an important part of my life. I've been going there for 30 years. I love it so much. I think I was born there a couple of hundred years ago. I really do. It's just such a part of my DNA. So anyway, they said, that's fine. I said, I'll move the location so it won't be where these other books are set, but it's still set in the south of France. And the protagonist is still going to be a mature woman. So I wrote Drawing Lessons, which is set around and in the town of Arles, which is a little more west from Provence. And the protagonist was a 62-year-old woman. And I loved writing that book. But I also realized when that was finished, and this sounds really stupid for an author, because imagine how fortunate I was to be approached by a publisher instead of, you know, having to work really hard to get the attention of one. And I realized that I was so lucky to have that happen. But I also knew that in my life, with my big family, which is a really important part of my life, my husband's health problems and also when he was well, us traveling a lot, that I couldn't keep up with the deadlines. I knew it would be a very stressful life.
So one, what you say is so important for authors is to know what your goals are when it comes to publishing, to know what your boundaries are, to know where writing is going to fit into your life in between everything else, because some authors have very different goals. Some are like, I just want to get traditionally published and I'll work myself to death and I'll have no life. And that is great. But they may not end up very happy. And I think it's amazing that you sat and you went, this was a wonderful opportunity and I'm grateful for it, but this is not necessarily what I want for myself, because I think authors really need to stop and define success for themselves every few years, define if this is still bringing them joy. Because here's the thing, we come to writing for the joy of it. But when it becomes a job, and we have deadlines and we're working so hard, a lot of the joy is sucked out of it because suddenly it's not this fun hobby anymore. It's like the grind, right? So in terms of the deadlines, like with Lake Union, with what were they expecting you to do in terms of turning books around? Like what were those deadlines like?
Well, I mean, again, remember, this is going back a number of years. But I mean, some of my closest writing friends are still our Lake Union authors who came to Lake Union about the same time I did, but they've stayed with them all these years. And that's wonderful. But I appreciate, you know, I talk to them and I know that they're under deadline and, you know, got the second edit has to be back in 2 more weeks and that kind of thing. And I mean, maybe, you know, maybe I just wasn't committed enough to want to have the pressure of those deadlines. I mean, because the reality is, as you know, when you're fortunate enough to have your book picked up, it goes into the assembly line. There's a publishing date, and there are all those other deadlines that have to be met before the book can be published. And you have to meet them. I know, again, from talking with friends, things happen in life. And if you have a personal crisis, you know, and you simply cannot make the deadline, of course, they're going to do their best. Publisher is going to do their best to try and accommodate you. But I just didn't want to have that stress.
So like some publishers have a book a year deadline. Some publishers have like 2 books a year deadline. So, and then what Patricia was talking about, all those other deadlines is you've got like the copy edit deadline and you've got the proofreading deadline and you've, but prior to that, it's a developmental edits deadline. And, you know, it's all of these different deadlines, plus you having to work on the next book because they want the next book delivered by a certain deadline. So you're writing a new book, you're copywriting another book, you're promoting another book. So it can become a lot. It really, really can.
Yeah. And perhaps if I'd started when I was 30 or 40, I would have had a different outlook on it and a different commitment, because certainly I appreciate the benefits of being with a big traditional publisher. And the main benefit, of course, is financial, because their reach is so much greater than an indie reach. And so, I mean, I'm fortunate that I wasn't writing to support my family, which might not have been a good thing. I might not have had the right attitude for that. But no, the years that I was with Lake Union were very profitable. It was very exciting to see so many books being sold. And certainly as an indie, I don't sell as that many books. But again, it's not a big deal because I'm older and because I'm not supporting my family. I appreciate young writers. I mean, they have a lot of goals, and they're writing because they love writing, for sure, because if you don't love it, you can't do it.
So then after that, you went back to indie publishing. Is that right? Tell us a bit more about that.
I did, yes. Well, I realized after Drawing Lessons came out that I just didn't want to live by those deadlines all the time. And so Lake Union was really great because a lot of readers who had read my Provence series were getting back to me again and saying, hey, what's going on with those characters? We really, you know, we love Kat and Philippe. And I have a woman in her 90s, Simone, who's a very interesting character. And they wanted to know more about them. So that's a gift to an author, really, you know, to have your reader so engaged with your characters. And because you're engaged with them, too. And so to write about them was great. So I, over the course of a couple of years, I self-pubbed four, well, short novels, they call them now, like novellas, right? 250, 280 pages, that kind of thing. Four different books following all those characters. And so that was really a lot of fun. And then COVID came along. And I was thinking, I'd like to write another novel. And so I had a short, again, a novella from way back that I had. And I decided to take a look at that and turn it into a novel. So that became The Secrets We Hide. And, you know, it's interesting. And I did send it to Lake Union. And because I'd been told that, hey, you know, even if you don't want to write anything now, if you have anything, send it to us. So, but the issue with that was that my protagonist was a Japanese man. And, you know, a few years ago, cultural appropriation was a big deal with publishers. And so that was kind of an issue. And they said, no, I don't think it's not for us. So I just put it out there. And I loved that book. It was a different, it was a bit of a switch for me. My books are normally described as having quiet plots. You know, nothing really exciting happens. It's more about the characters and the locations and the lifestyle and what's happening within their relationships with their family and whatnot. And so this was a book that focused very much on mental health. And it was set in Hawaii and Japan. And of course, eventually it got to the south of France because I have to do that. But it's won four very nice awards. And I think it's a good book. I think somebody might have been interested in it, but I just put it up myself.
What's fascinating to me is how you found your audience, because that is the biggest, I think it's a bigger struggle for authors, is to tap into who their audience is and to have their audience constantly be in touch and go, I want more of this. I want more of this. You know, it's extremely difficult. And I think that sometimes where indie authors do better than traditionally published authors, because they, I don't know, the indie authors I know have really found their fans. They build up a fandom way quicker and much more loyal than traditionally published authors. Do you think that's right, or do you think that's not a fair assessment?
No, I think that's a very good assessment, actually. And I wonder if it's because as indie authors, we really appreciate the connections that we have with our readers. Not that other authors don't, but it's just a more intimate connection, I think.
Can I ask as well, because once the connection happens, it's great, because as a traditionally published author, I love connecting with my readers as well, but it's to get the book in their hands so that they can connect in the first place. So can I ask, your first indie published books, were they at a price point that made it possible for people to go, I'm going to take a chance on this debut author, as opposed to if it's a hardcover or if it's a softcover? People are like, I've never heard of this person before. I'm not spending $25 or whatever on this. So sometimes that's something, because people will look at Amazon and go, oh, this is only like $2.99. So I'm prepared to take that chance. Was that part of your marketing campaign in the beginning?
It did become part of it. I mean, first of all, I have to credit Lake Union with building up my readership. I mean, you know, let's face it. I hate to, you know, it's not a well-received word these days, but Amazon has a reach, you know. And so in those 4 years that my books were being published by Amazon, I reached a lot of readers. And fortunately, a lot of those readers stayed with me. I don't think I'd have the readership I have today had it not been for Amazon. And another thing that Amazon does is even after your book is out there, they keep promoting it. You know, I love, even now, I get emails from Amazon marketing saying, hi, we want to let you know that, you know, the Promise of Provence is going to be on sale next month for $2.99. Thank you, Amazon. That's great.
Yeah. That is incredible because it does mean that people are prepared to take a chance, like I say, on an author that they haven't tried before, because it doesn't, like, spending $2.99 versus $25 or now $30 or whatever the heck books cost these days, you know, it's a big sort of difference. But Patricia, mm-hmm. we've only got like 5 minutes left. So tell us about your latest book.
Well, listen, we still have a lot to talk about, Bianca.
I know, but we have 5 minutes left. So this is, I think we're going to have to get you to write more for our newsletter, Patricia. But show up you've got the cover here for those of you who are looking at you on YouTube.
Let's I do, see. Yes. So this is my new book, The French Effect. And it was just a joy to write. I wanted to write something that was just fun but interesting. And of course, everything I write is set in France. So if you don't like France, don't worry about buying my books because I talk about it a lot, you know, and it's just a big part of, I mean, it really is, I guess, my brand. I mean, my newsletters are full of photos from France. For 10 years, I did a women's tour based on my books. Imagine how much fun that was. Yeah, 2-week tour was just great. There are some other things sort of cooking in the pot. But anyway, this book is getting great reviews. The advanced readers are all busy posting right now, and it comes out on November 15th. And I'm really thrilled with it. It's just a happy story, has some very interesting things happen. It's about a woman, a widow, a novelist from a small ski town 2 hours north of Toronto.
Oh my goodness.
But I don't actually mention the name of the town. And her daughter is an artist in Paris. And she calls her mom saying that her next door neighbor has an emergency. She's leaving for 6 weeks in Mexico and she needs a dog sitter for her Doberman. So her mom doesn't like to make snap decisions, but she convinces her to go over and take on this project. And it's all about the people she meets and the places she goes and the handsome young Frenchman who introduces her to the tango. Because the French are very big in the tango, you know. Anyway, it's a fun read, and it's set in December and January in Paris at Christmas, which is magic, and then in the countryside of Provence over the actual Christmas days, and I think people will really enjoy it.
Yeah, you're such an inspiration. Sorry, when I heard tango, I winced, because the only time my husband and I have ever done a dance class together was for somebody's birthday party where they got in a dance instructor who, I don't know why, thought that teaching everyone the tango would be the best way to go. And as we did the turn, my husband kneed me in the crotch so badly that I actually couldn't walk for a week. So I'm not a big fan of the tango, but I'm a big fan of yours, Patricia. As I said, such an excellent literary citizen. Such a wonderful, wonderful person, a big cheerleader of writers. So for our listeners, we're going to link to the book on our bookshop.org affiliate page. Please get it there and dive into Patricia's backlist. That's the most amazing thing because, you know, at the moment, I don't think anybody can actually buy a brand new physical copy of my debut, Hum If You Don't Know the Words, because it's my understanding Penguin Random House has just stopped printing it. So you can get it on Kindle, but you can't get it printed, which
is nice.
No, it's frustrating and it's maddening, but like for you, your whole backlist is there and everyone can just go and dive into it. So there was a lot that we weren't able to cover. I had so many more questions, but this conversation was so fascinating. I'm definitely going to chat to Patricia and see if we can get her to do something for the newsletter for all the points we didn't get to. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Bianca. I would love to do that because there is so much to talk about. And I love it when I talk with new writers in our writing groups that we are developing. And I often say to them, you know what? Of course, it's wonderful if you can get an agent and a publisher. But if you can't, If you have this book and it's lovely and you believe in it, get it out there. And once people start reading it, maybe the publisher will come to you.
Perfect place to end.
Hey, everybody. Guess who's back from France? I was thinking of you guys listening to me talk about getting ready for the trip and practicing my French while I was doing my best order en français at the cafes. It went well. I was a bit nervous, but when we were in the countryside and I could take my time thinking about what I wanted to say, I was able to say it. Being a bilingual family is high on my list of things that are super important to me as a parent and a mom. If we're going to show them the world, we also need to appreciate and respect the language and culture by learning it. Imagine how much richer your travel experience could be if you could speak the local languages when you travel. With Rosetta Stone, you'll gain the confidence to have real conversations and create deeper connections wherever you go. Rosetta Stone is the trusted leader in language learning for over 30 years. Their immersive, intuitive method helps you naturally absorb and retain your new language on desktop or mobile, whenever and wherever it fits your summer schedule. With 30 years of experience, millions of users, and 25 languages to choose from, including Spanish, French, German, Japanese, and more, Rosetta Stone is the go-to tool for real language growth. You can learn faster and retain longer. There's no English translations. You truly learn to speak, listen, and think in your chosen language. There's an intuitive learning process. You start with words, build to phrases, and progress to full sentences. It's designed for long-term retention, so it sticks with you. You can work on your accent with the built-in True Accent speech recognition technology, so it'll help you sound more natural. You can learn anytime, anywhere. It fits with your lifestyle with a flexible on-the-go learning style, desktop or mobile app. And there's incredible value. A lifetime membership gives you access to all 25 languages, so you can learn as many as you want whenever you want. Don't wait. Unlock your language learning potential now. The Shit About Writing listeners can grab Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. That's unlimited access to 25 language courses for life. Visit rosettastone.com/today to get started and claim your 50% off today. Don't miss out. Go to rosettastone.com/today and start learning today. The holidays are almost here, and if you still have names on your list, don't panic. Uncommon Goods makes holiday shopping stress-free and joyful with thousands of one-of-a-kind gifts you can't find anywhere else. You'll discover presents that feel meaningful and personal, never rushed or last minute. Uncommon Goods looks for products that are high quality, unique, and often handmade or made in the U.S. Many are crafted by independent artists and small businesses, so every gift feels special and thoughtfully chosen. I know our crowd would love the Book Nook Reading Valet. It's a wood holder for your book, your mug, your reading glasses, e-reader, and or phone, so you can carry it from your room to your bedside to the bathtub. It has a 4.9 out of 5 rating on over 178 reviews. I also thought you guys would like, all of you pet lovers out there, would like the custom pet embroidered sweatshirt, so you can have a custom portrait of your animal on your sweater and have them with you all day. Uncommon Goods has something for everybody, from moms and dads to kids and teens, book lovers, sports fans and foodies, gardeners, crafters, readers and writers. You will find unforgettable gifts that are anything but ordinary. When you shop at Uncommon Goods, you're supporting artists and small independent businesses. Every purchase is a chance to choose something remarkable and feel good about where your money goes, because you can make your money go farther this holiday season, because with every purchase you make at Uncommon Goods, they give back $1 to a nonprofit partner of your choice. They've donated more than $3.1 million to date. That is incredible stuff. So don't wait. Make this holiday the year you give something truly unforgettable. To get 15% off your next gift, go to uncommongoods.com/tsnotya. That's uncommongoods.com/tsnotyaw for 15% off. Don't miss out on this limited time offer, Uncommon Goods. We're all out of the ordinary.
Hey everyone, welcome back to another comps segment with the ever fabulous Emily Summer from East City Bookshop. Emily, welcome back to the show.
It is great to be back. Thank you, Bianca.
Yeah, I don't know what the hell happened in October, man. Everybody was snoozing, or I don't know, they all became comp geniuses, or what happened?
Well, people are comp geniuses. Everybody is well-trained, so that's it. And I don't know if people are like, we are in DC, there was a lot going on in October, so I get it.
It's probably just as well. Okay, so we're going to dive in. Here's our first one.
Hi, I'm looking for a second comp for my contemporary literary novel in the vein of Lily King's Writers and Lovers that follows a disillusioned 32-year-old cubicle worker struggling to recreate her life in the wake of her mother's sudden death while contending with family secrets and her own abandoned dreams of becoming an artist. It explores the intersection of grief and desire and the emotional reckoning of second chances with psychological acuity and some quiet dark humor. The protagonist does everything she can to avoid her grief, including developing a renewed fixation on her ex-boyfriend, a successful photographer living with his new artist partner in Brooklyn. But when she stakes him out, she learns their life's not all it appears to be. More facades crumble when her long-estranged father resurfaces as the surprising co-executor to her mother's will. She's forced to face her grief, let go of what never truly was, to create a life she really wants to live. I'd love to hear any other ideas you might have for a couple more comps. Thank you so much.
Okay. Writers and lovers. Oh, as soon as I hear writers and lovers, I hear Lily King. I am immediately invested. I am a Lily King super fan. I am a writers and lovers super fan. So I love this comp and I love the description of your book that we've gotten. For all the other Lily King fans and writers and lovers fans, I know there are lots of us out there. Get to an indie bookstore if you have not read Lily King's latest, Heart the Lover. So that's apropos of nothing except we all need to read it. A comp that I always recommend for a reader who loves writers and lovers or is looking for something similar is Ghosts by Dolly Alderton. I love Dolly Alderton and I love Ghosts in particular. And I think it hits the same notes as writers and lovers because it's such a pleasure to read. It's so easy to read, but there's so much wisdom and substance and great writing. In Ghosts, there is not traditional grief in that one, but there is some anticipatory grief as the main character's parents are aging and her father is ill. So tonally, I think it works well in terms of just like life stage and psychological acuity. And that also reminds me of Goodbye Vitamin by Rachel Kong, which might work well too. It's possible that that one is too old, but I think Rachel Kong certainly is not too old, although Goodbye Vitamin is her previous book. It's completely different from her more recent book, Real Americans, which I'm sure people are aware of. But what I like about all these books, Writers and Lovers, Ghosts, Goodbye Vitamin, they all have a 20-something, 30-something young adult narrator who is struggling, but they're not a hot mess. You know, you understand what they're going through. You understand why they're in the situation that they're in, and they're easy to root for. And along the same lines, a more recent book that I think hits those same notes. This is one of my favorites of 2025, and it's Emily Everett's All That Life Can Afford. It was a Reese pick, so I think it got some initial attention, but otherwise I think it's been a bit underrated. And our main character in that one is grieving her mother's death. And she's also working to create that life that balances her passion, which in her case is English lit. She's getting a master's degree with actually surviving and making a living. So I think that that one works too. It definitely reminded me of Lily King when I read it, which is my highest praise. I will also suggest a book that I'm currently reading that I hope will make a splash next year in 2026. And it's called Mothers and Other Strangers by Corey Ann Haydu. It's coming from Little Brown. And it's about, as the title suggests, mothers and daughters, and about balancing sort of the eventual life you end up with your artist's dreams. But I'm really enjoying that one. So just a little rec for future reference.
Love it. Thank you. We actually got to see Lily King in Toronto when she was out recently promoting the book. And for our listeners, if you want to see a picture of absolute joy, go to the Instagram account of Suze Dugard. She was our newsletter editor, and find the picture of her and Lily King together. Lily said it was one of her absolute favorites, and it's just such a joyful picture. So go and look that one up. Okay, here is number two.
Hi, I'm looking for comp titles for my adult literary historical fiction debut. The novel begins in 1989 and follows three female friends, one Jewish American, one Jewish Israeli, and one who's mixed race and Catholic, living in a small fictional city in upstate New York. Told Rashomon style, with each of them getting a POV, the narrative is divided into three sections revolving around key events, both in their lives at 16, 26 and 31, backgrounded by large-scale historical events such as the Berlin Wall coming down. The themes are complex female friendship and American identity. I've thought of Fellowship Point and Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow, and although they're not sisters, I wonder if Us Fools or Blue Sisters might work, but I'd love to have a comp that signals the diversity of these characters and their community. Thanks.
I love a friendship story, and I love the suggestions that you've made. I think Fellowship Point, Us Fools, Blue Sisters, I like those. I totally get where you're going. And the one that I will add is The Wilderness by Angela Flournoy, which just came out in 2025. It was longlisted for our National Book Award. And it reminds me of your description because it is also several different women, multi-POVs from all of them, and the timelines jump back and forth as well throughout. This one is more contemporary. It doesn't go all the way back to the 80s, if I remember correctly. But you jump not just from the characters' perspectives, but you jump from to different timelines as well, or different time periods as well. It is very much about American identity and complex female friendships and female relationships. None of the characters in the book are Jewish. These are all Black American women. And I do think that sounds like a significant part of this novel. But in terms of structure and content and themes otherwise, I think that The Wilderness sounds like it's a really good fit. It was really good. It was very powerful. I highly recommend that one for a great 2025 read.
Thank you, Emily. Okay, here we go to number three.
Hi, I'm looking for comps for my work in progress, young adult / new adult pirate romantasy. My protagonist longs to escape her tyrant boss and find her brother. Her only form of escape is sailing with a fearsome pirate ship, along with a series of trials recruits must complete in order to stay on board. The only person who might be able to help her through is the handsome first mate she's unsure she can trust. Inspired by Caribbean mythology and my love for Pirates of the Caribbean, previous comps I've thought of have been Daughter of the Pirate King and Fourth Wing for the recruiting trials. Although I think that's too big, so any help would be welcome. Thank you.
So yes, I think you're right. Fourth Wing is probably too big. I can't think of a bigger romantasy. That every title that I get in a catalog from a publisher these days is like, this is the next Fourth Wing. Well, they can't all be. So I think you're right to steer clear of that. But to get the same idea and the same reader, maybe look at The Serpent and the Wings of Night by Carissa Broadbent. So in that book, there's a tournament that gives you the same sort of high stakes adventure part of Fourth Wing. Instead of fellow recruits, you have the competitors. And along those same lines too, maybe look at the Schoolmance series by Naomi Novik. I know I've recommended her in the past, and I think she's on the cusp of being too big. She is certainly big, but I don't think that she is that like so big that people discount it. And the first in that series is called A Deadly Education. And I think both of those books that I've mentioned will capture some of the elements and appeal of Fourth Wing without the name that's going to be sort of alienating.
Wonderful. Thank you. Okay, here's number four.
Hi, Emily. Thank you so much for doing this. I'm writing a literary suspense told from the perspective of a middle-aged woman in suburbia who has never gotten over the death of her friend, which happened when they were both children. She's pretty reclusive, but does have one acquaintance in her apartment complex who comes over unannounced all the time. And on one such occasion, she shares with the protagonist that a neighbor girl has been found dead in the area. Together, they try to solve the case while the main character works through her own guilt and arrested development because of the loss of her friend 30 years before. Ashley Flowers' The Missing Half might be good, but my story is more voicey and there's a lot of dark humor. There's also a little piece of the puzzle that brings us back to the 1700s.
I am so glad you said The Missing Half by Ashley Flowers because I already had that in my head. And I know I've mentioned that here before. But you said that yours is voicey and has some dark humor. I found The Missing Half very voicey. It was one of the things I liked about it. And I think it's sort of sharp and had some of that dark humor in it. So I think that's a good fit. I would not, the voicey makes it more of a fit to me instead of less of one. For the dark humor, I will add Listen to the Lie by Amy Tintera. Also super voicey, but very darkly funny. For a book about, you know, your friend's death that you've never gotten over, it's really funny. And I really enjoyed reading it. It's a fun read. I'm intrigued by the piece of your story that goes back to, I think you said the 1700s. And for that aspect, maybe look at Amelia Hart's book, The Sirens. It is not the suspense and the thriller that The Missing Half and Listen to the Lie are, but it's definitely literary, it's definitely suspenseful, and it also has a contemporary versus historical angle that might be a nice match for that part of your story.
Wonderful. Okay, we almost at halfway mark, number five.
I'm looking for comps for my speculative romance. Tallulah James has just met the man of her dreams. He's enigmatic, sensitive, and sexy. He's a world-famous rock star, and he's crazy about her. The only problem? He's been dead for 50 years. Orphaned young, Tallulah was adopted by the Aunties, the free-spirited lesbian couple who run the most iconic record shop on the Venice Beach boardwalk. When Aunt Rosie is diagnosed with a rare memory disorder, Tallulah's fragile sense of home starts to unravel, until vivid lucid dreams pull her somewhere impossible, into the arms of Jack Maddox, the doomed frontman of her favorite 60s rock band. Tallulah discovers her connection with Jack's band's lifetimes, transcending time itself. With the clock running out on their faded romance, she must discover whether their love is powerful enough to rewrite history or if loving Jack will cost her everything she has left. Most of my comps are either too old or too big. Some I've considered are Ashley Poston's The 7-Year Slip, Addie LaRue, Outlander, and The Time Traveler's Wife for epic love stories that transcend time, and Daisy Jones and the Six for Los Angeles rock and roll nostalgia. Thanks for your help.
Okay, I love this pitch. You know, I love a rock star, dead or alive. I think you're right on the money with The 7-Year Slip by Ashley Poston. If I hear anything that has that sort of light speculative element to what is otherwise might be a fun romance, I think of her. So I think that's great. I love the mention of these record shop aunties. I'm already ready to read it. So definitely Ashley Poston. That feels right. I think she's not too big to comp. I think you're right. Daisy Jones is too big. The other's too old. So this is kind of a wild one that captures the same Daisy Jones aspect, but Cameron Crowe's recent memoir, The Uncool, it just came out. It's a memoir. He's a music critic. It's about his days as a music journalist, not critic, but it's basically the movie Almost Famous in memoir form. That's what Almost Famous was based on. So I don't know if there's a way to mention a memoir and have it bring up the same vibes. There's also a new book coming out next year called Wreck Your Heart by Lori Raider Day that they are pitching to readers of Daisy Jones. And I think it is an effective pitch. And the people that I've heard who have read it already have really liked the book and think that it will do really well. So depending on your timeline and that publishing timeline, that's one you might be on the lookout for. And then just in general, maybe look at, you know, I'm thinking of something like, is it Alyssa Sussman meets Matt Haig? With Alyssa Sussman writes such good celebrity normie romances, and Matt Haig writes such good lightly speculative lit fic. So I'll throw those out there and see if there's any way that that fits as well.
Thank you, Emily. Number 6.
I'm looking for comp titles for a women's fiction novel about a Hollywood publicist whose bad behavior as the meanest, bullying boss in town blows up her life spectacularly. She's assigned to community service at the county zoo, cleaning up after goats and learning from a cute zookeeper about the importance of wildlife conservation and our place in the natural world. She also has to attend a court-ordered 12-step program as anger management, which helps her unpack the trauma of her past that caused her to behave so monstrously. If she can learn to put others before herself, she can use her PR skills to launch a huge star-studded campaign to raise money and awareness for endangered species, and find a happy ever after with her zookeeper sweetheart. Other than the TV show Single Drunk Female, I haven't thought of any women's fiction comps or romances that deal with a mean protagonist who betters herself, 12-step groups, zoos, or the entertainment publicity machine.
Okay, I love a bad, mean main character who has to get her comeuppance. My favorite Hollywood novel in recent years is The Work Wife by Allison B. Hart. It's got that Hollywood insider angle, and it's got personal assistants in it, but it's got publicists too. But it's got these very insider characters with questionable motives and morals who are forced to come to a reckoning. It's more of a Me Too novel than it is like an unlikable female protagonist novel. But I think that it's right in that Hollywood wheelhouse, and it's excellent. So I would look at that just to see, does it make any sense as a comp? And if not, you're going to read a great book anyway. And then in terms of, you know, I also can't think of anyone where a really mean main character's bad behavior blows up her life. But in terms of like very complex, unlikable, but maybe relatable, well-written characters in general, I am thinking of Taffy Brodesser Ackner, Fleischman Is in Trouble, Long Island Compromise. And I'm also thinking about Maria Semple. So of course, her most famous was Where'd You Go, Bernadette, which is too old. But she's got a new one coming out next year called Go Gentle, which I've not read yet. But I feel like both of them do a really good job of writing these characters who you're like, what are you doing? And why are you doing it? And I don't understand. But then you kind of come around to it. So something to think about.
Marvelous. Okay, number 7.
I'm looking for comps for my book, Blending Contemporary Sci-Fi with Women's Fiction with 3 POVs. Olivia Finnegan is a woman who wakes up realizing she has been kidnapped by a highly skilled international group of superhumans who fight for the protection of other Aleks in their gene-altered futuristic world. Believing her capture is a mistake, she fights to take it back to her husband and daughter, but she finds out she has the gene variant giving her advanced abilities. The other Aleks, including the 2 other POVs, try to convince her to train and to stay away from her family to keep them all safe. Being wildly in love with her husband back home and with being a mother, Olivia is driven to deeply explore who she is without these tags and how her newfound abilities will fit into her old life. This book dives deep into subjects of motherhood, self-identity, marriage, and grit. The memories of her husband and the male relationships she develops will make you debate if you're Team Callum, Team Bear, or Team Jackson, while falling head over heels for Team Olivia. My book has similar world feel to This Mortal Coil, which is too old, and dramatic twists like Wild Dark Shore, which is too big. I appreciate any suggestions.
Okay, I always mention Blake Crouch. Drink when Emily suggests Blake Crouch, if there was a drinking game for this segment. Drink when I suggest Blake Crouch. But I mention Blake Crouch all the time because I do think he's just that good. And I think he's the best at blending like very grounded realism with these superhuman, techie, sci-fi possibilities. So take a look at the great Blake Crouch. And the superhuman abilities aspect also made me think immediately of V.E. Schwab's Vicious and Vengeful, although she is probably too big and those are older. But I think that the superhuman abilities part might work there. And look too at Helen Phillips's novels. So she wrote The Need and more recently Hum. The Need especially is about motherhood and the demands of motherhood and balancing your real self and motherhood. And she also does a great job of what Blake Crouch does, which is blend our real world and our real, like very real seeming lives with this futuristic sci-fi possibility.
Awesome. Okay, number 8.
Hi, I'm Stacey. I'm a huge fan of Tisnot. Yeah, and thank you so much for doing this. I'm looking for a comp for my novel, Burn Down the World. It's a dual POV YA fantasy that's a love story between sisters at its core. Half portal fantasy quest with terrifying elemental monsters, and half our world political intrigue with terrifying men. It's about overly confident Princess Lys, who magically swaps bodies with her sister, Queen Ari, to take her place on a deadly underworld quest. While Lys fights soul-sucking elemental monsters alongside the son of her father's assassin, Ari works with a sorceress to get Lys back to this world alive, all while forming a resistance group and fighting to retake her throne from the old man who's usurped her. Thank you so much.
Okay, the YA fantasy and adult romantasy, those, as you have all probably figured out, these are my hardest. But I had a couple of immediate thoughts for this YA fantasy with political intrigue. The first thing that I thought of was Three Dark Crowns by Kendari Blake. It's older, but the political intrigue and the battle over the throne feel like it would be right. For the same reasons, I thought Holly Black's The Cruel Prince, that whole series seems like a really logical comp. Less obvious and more recent would be the book Sisters of the Snake, which is actually by sisters. Their last name is Nanua or Nanua, N-A-N-U-A. I actually don't know how well that did in terms of like a sales track, but I would take a look at it because if I recall correctly, it has both the sister angle and the very high stakes political battle. So I think there are definitely some similarities there.
Awesome. Okay, number 9.
My name is Julia, and I'm looking for comp titles for my debut psychological thriller, Beneath the Surface. Beneath the Surface follows Mallory, a burnt-out pre-med student who joins her best friends, Estelle and Rory, for a hiking trip in the Appalachian Mountains. What begins as a much-needed escape spirals into a waking nightmare, with strange sickness, mountain folklore bleeding into reality, and a charming stranger who blurs Mallory's grip on reality. Things quickly sour. As her body fails and paranoia sets in, Mallory discovers the real danger isn't in the mountains. It's beside her. Estelle, her lifelong best friend, has been drugging her, slowly stealing her identity and trying to live Mallory's perfect life for herself. The novel blends psychological tension with atmospheric survival elements and is intended for new adult and adult readers who enjoy stories about female rivalry, identity, and the quiet violence of envy with a touch of romance. Thank you so much for your time.
Okay, plot-wise, this is different, but I have to mention Heartwood by Amity Gage because that is the current book on hiking survival, The Appalachian Trail, and it is so good. Everyone should read it. It's one of those books that I think you can put in almost anyone's hands because it's got so much and it's just so wonderful. So absolutely, if you all have not read Heartwood by Amity Gage yet, that is one of my 2025 faves. I also immediately remembered an older horror movie called The Descent, which is about a group of friends, female friends, who go spelunking. And then, man, they're down in this cave and bad stuff starts to happen. And I was going to say it's older, like maybe 10 years old, but I looked it up and turns out it was 20 years old. So that's why sometimes I can't pinpoint which titles are too old to recommend. It all seems recent enough to me, but I recommend The Descent as a horror movie if anybody is a horror watcher. In terms of book comps, back to our topic, I always love to recommend both Peter Heller and Kimmy Cunningham Grant when it comes to any sort of suspense that has an element of action adventure or survivalism. They are both excellent at writing nature and the beauty of nature and also the terror of being stuck in nature and in the elements. And Kimmy Cunningham Grant's most recent book, which came out last year, The Nature of Disappearing, also has some of the friendship frenemy themes, the themes of envy, who can you trust, the complications of friendship and how dangerous that might be. So it has those same themes. So I think that one could be really good here.
Great. Okay, here is our last one.
Okay, so our last one I got in writing, actually. So this one was written in instead of sent as a voicemail. Still, please send it as a voice note if you can, but I will read this one so you get to hear it in my voice. Hello, thank you for this segment. It's very instructive. I'm looking for comps for my YA novel that is set in a school for spies. It takes place in the real world, and there's no supernatural elements in it, but I put in a lot of work on the lore and the world building. It's a secret community that has specific rules and a very rich history. So I strongly believe it can appeal to fantasy readers, even though there's no magic. Do you know of any books that could be good comps? I usually mention The Thieves Gambit, Six of Crows, and Wednesday the TV show, but I'd love to have more examples of books that are not fantasy, yet still have a great emphasis on world building. There's steampunk gothic elements in it as well, in case that's helpful. Thank you in advance. You are welcome. My first thought for a YA book that has this fantasy crossover appeal, but is not fantasy or magic, and that's Jennifer Lynn Barnes' The Inheritance Game series. Our customers, our readers at East City Bookshop love it. My kids read it. My husband read it, loved these books. And there's definitely some crossover between the things that you mentioned. It's realistic fiction, but it appeals to those Thieves Gambit, Leigh Bardugo, Wednesday fans that you mentioned. So I think look at Jennifer Lynn Barnes' The Inheritance Game series. And then for the gothic and steampunk elements, I thought immediately of the books of Gail Carringer, which that's exactly what those are. I don't know if there's magic in there. Maybe not. But either way, I think it has that crossover appeal. And it sounds like it would be right up the same alley for the readers that you're targeting. So that's what I'd go with. And that's it.
Amazing. Thank you so, so much again for taking the time. For those of you who want to submit for next month, please make sure you go to our website. There's Ask a Question. Please submit the recording. This time we included the person who put it on the form in the wrong place, but we can't always do that. So please submit the recording there and do it before the 10th of the month because we do record this segment quite early. But we're looking forward to hearing all your requests and I look forward to seeing you next month, Emily.
Look forward to seeing you and thank you all.
And that's it for today's episode. I hope you'll join us for next week's show. In the meantime, keep at it. Remember, it just takes one yes.
What's up, everyone? This is Cece. If you're a longtime listener of this podcast, then chances are you've heard me talk about the importance of writing on a line level. And of course I have. Because while movies get to rely on lighting, soundtrack, acting, and special effects, books rely only on words to make a story come to life, which is why the writing matters so much. My question to you is, are you confident about your writing? Do you feel like it's at the level it needs to be to stand out in the competitive publishing landscape? If you're like most writers I know, then you're always looking for ways to improve. Well, what if I told you that there's a way to supercharge your learning experience by hacking writing on a line level? That's right. Hacking It. I've developed an original 4-day course, Hacking Writing on a Line Level, that will show you specific techniques to elevate your writing on a word level, sentence level, paragraph level, and scene level. This course begins on December 4th. My favorite part about it is that there are clear, specific examples in every single slide. No fluff, all actionable content. And for the first time ever, we'll have an optional interactive component. Students are invited to submit excerpts from their work for a chance to have them critiqued live during a class. I'm super excited about this new format because I've seen it yield results in writers' works. And it works for writers of any genre, as long as you're serious about improving your writing on a line level, and as long as you're a reader. So if you're ready to take your writing to the next level, join me for this 4-day course. It's a fan favorite. Don't worry if you can't attend live. The sessions will be recorded. For more information, check out my bio on Instagram or the podcast's website. I'm looking forward to seeing you there.